our take on the big decision, next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to the Saturday edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principles and Policy. And along with me today, as usual, is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaelis.
And this is our first attempt at an hour-long show in how long?
Hours. It's been hours, yes. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we appreciate the fact that we wanted to share with you over the last number of weeks a taste of what camp was like at Camp American and the caliber of teaching and information that students from ages 12 and up receive when they come to camp. And Chuck, this year was no exception. We had some very, very solid teaching during this week. Folks heard from such luminaries as Tom DeWeese of the American Policy Center, Michael Kaufman of Environmental Perspectives, Pastor David Whitney from Institute on the Constitution, and Dr. Sasha Volacord, who is the outgoing chairman of the Business and Government Department at Ohio Christian University. But they also heard from you and me, too, because we also taught a couple classes apiece. But, folks, we decided that now camp's over with, we're going to kind of go back to our regular broadcast schedule, which is Chuck and I sitting here looking at something for more than 15 minutes at a stretch. Now, that may be good or may be bad, Chuck. We may be so rusty that we may not be able to stretch a full hour out. But you know what? While we were at camp, we were given a gift. And I say that fully tongue-in-cheek, ladies and gentlemen, so don't get me wrong. We were given a gift because during that week, the United States Supreme Court, actually a week ago Thursday, announced their decision in the case on whether or not Obamacare, the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, was a constitutional exercise of the congressional power or whether it was an unconstitutional overreach and broadening of federal authority. Well, Charles, I think what happened is they said sand, because as everybody has heard, the ruling came down that Obamacare was constitutional, but only when they reworked everything in order to say that the individual mandate and its penalty was not a penalty, which would have been, according to the justice's decision, a violation of the Commerce Clause, but a tax, so that it was constitutional under the taxing powers of Congress found in Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. This is one of these, depending on which camp you're coming from, this was either judicial moderation and responsible jurisprudence, and that's coming from everything from the liberals to some of the conservatives who are trying to save getting a black eye because John Roberts was the swing vote in this effort, to what our take is going to be in great part today, ladies and gentlemen, is that this was a breathtaking expansion of federal power under the taxation clause that will have significant negative ramifications for how you and I live our daily lives from here on out, unless there is action taken either by our elected officials or by the American public in relation to this atrocity.
Well, I think it's interesting that from the left, pundits were screaming about when it looked like it was going to go down in toto. The left was screaming about that Roberts was about to plunge the nation into political crisis. And then afterwards, he's basically being praised for his, quote, humility, restraint, for being brave. And I love this one, judicial modesty. Is there any such thing? I don't see it. But the fact is that this whole thing is so convoluted. In fact, basically what the Supreme Court did here was not so much strike down the law or let stand pieces of it. They reshaped it completely as if they were a legislative body fine-tuning a law that had already been passed. because basically what they said was, well, no, you can't pass this under the Commerce Clause, but you can pass it under the Taxing Clause, which is exactly the opposite of what the Congress did. And not only that, they said the states can't be responsible for an expanded Medicaid portion. Now, that's legislative activity. That is not court activity. Okay, the courts can't make law. Let's be clear on that. But what they did was they took the law and they tinkered with it. It's sort of like if they didn't like the design of a car. So they basically, you know, pulled the carburation system and pulled the transmission and pulled the drivetrain and basically replaced it and said, voila, look, it's the same car. Well, it isn't the same car. It's got a different transmission, it's got a different drivetrain, and it's got a different carburation system.
But the nameplate on it says the same thing.
Yeah, exactly. It's sort of like pulling the flathead six out of a 32 Ford and replacing it with a V8 and saying, look, the nameplate's the same. Or should I say possibly pulling a V8 out of a modern car and replacing it with a flathead six is maybe more like what happened here. But the fact is that this was legislative tinkering by the judicial branch, and that really isn't their job. In fact, their job really isn't the law review at all. And where does it leave the states? Well, states like Ohio, for instance, have a constitutional prohibition against being involved in the program at all. And a number of states have done the same thing. So now the battle gets down to whether or not the law will be nullified. Now, I think we may want to leave that and come back to it later.
Yes, I think that we should.
But the fact is, that's now where everything stands. We've got a tax, and if you'll notice, the Obama administration is jumping up and down, screaming at the top of their lungs that this isn't a tax, this is under the Commerce Clause. At this point, it doesn't matter. The Supreme Court has said, no, if it's under the Commerce Clause, you can't do it, which really means that they've sort of reined in the Commerce Clause, but they've opened up other avenues at this point for the government to come in and do things.
Well, that's right, Chuck. They absolutely have. And honestly, Charles, what they've done actually is worse than the Commerce Clause jurisprudence that has been going on in this country under these courts since 1937, where they took a clause that our founders meant for just basic trade and diplomacy issues and turned it into a sledgehammer for the government to be able to dictate certain aspects of American life. I believe, though, shifting this decision with its broad implications in relation to health care from under the Commerce Clause, which Roberts couldn't bring himself to approve, and putting it under Article 1, Section 8, Clause, I believe, 1, which is the Congress's power to tax, broadened the power of this supposedly limited and enumerated authority of Congress to something that was absolutely breathtaking. Because it says in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1, the Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises, to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States, but all duties, imposts, and excises shall be uniform throughout the United States. So that's that clause. But now, according to the decision handed down by Chief Justice Roberts and four of the most liberal members of the court, being Elena Kagan, Sonia Sotomayor, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and Stephen Breyer, we now have said that anything Congress wants to do that they want to force upon American citizens and require them to either act or refrain from acting, as long as they put a penalty with it, well, we'll find that as a tax, and then therefore it's legitimate.
Well, not only that, it's under the jurisdiction of the most abusive agency, bar none. It's under their purview, and that's the Internal Revenue Service.
The Internal Revenue Service, as many people call it, yeah.
Who essentially is allowed to, in complete violation of constitutional protocol, is allowed to go in and seize your bank account and essentially frees you out of your economic life. And that, and as more and more and more federal regulations have come about, and it's harder and harder and harder to operate in cash, and it's harder and harder and harder to operate in cash because the IRS wants to make sure that they get their cut. And I don't want to lay it all on the IRS. The IRS is doing what they're ordered to do by Congress and the president. So anytime people are told to blame the IRS, I'm sorry, ladies and gentlemen, they're just simply doing what the power, they're using the power that they've been given by Congress. So you can ask your congressman at a town hall meeting why he is allowing the IRS to run roughshod over this situation and why they're being given all this power and why all these new IRS agents are being, as the Declaration of Independence put it, let's see if I can find it here. Because I want to get the quote right.
Okay.
This is a very important quote. It's one of the main complaints in the Declaration of Independence.
And it says, he has erected a multitude of new offices and sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people and eat out their substance.
And that, ladies and gentlemen, is a perfect description of the Internal Revenue Service.
Yes, it is, as a matter of fact.
Well, but it's not just the IRS. It's all the agencies that are being prepared that will handle the new healthcare law.
Well, of course, Health and Human Services is already gearing up, and they've been given over $1 billion in the federal budget to implement the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. And between the HHS and the IRS, they've already blown through that $1 billion, have written over 13,000 pages of new federal regulations that will be put into place, or likely put into place, and are going on a hiring frenzy. Now, Chuck, you know, one of the things that I think the American public, and you see every month, is worried about, and that's the unemployment numbers.
Exactly.
I think what's happening is HHS and the Department and the IRS are going to try to take it upon themselves to bring us under the 5% unemployment rate by hiring every possible person they can hope to hire in order to implement this health care plan.
Well, let's look at it from the opposite direction. I'm a small businessman. You're a small businessman. Is this going to make you more or less likely able to hire additional help?
It's going to make it next to impossible to be able to bring anybody on because the costs are going to be so prohibitive and so restrictive that, you know, it used to be, Chuck, that when you, and most people out there, ladies and gentlemen, whether you work for somebody else or you are a small business owner, you realize that the old math was that if you're going to be bringing on somebody, your actual cost of that hire was about 1.7 to 1.8 times their actual annual salary that you were going to pay them. And that counted benefits, health care, vacation, sick leave, it's unemployment compensation, the FICA, whatever taxes you had to pay on that employee. So it was about 1.7, 1.8. Chuck, I'm thinking now if somebody did the calculations with the Obamacare ruling being made constitutional, we're probably looking at somewhere in a factor of 2.1 to 2.3 times the annual salary that you would have to set aside in order just to pay for all the taxes.
Oh, absolutely. And that is one of the things that's going to make it more restrictive. That's only part of the cost, though, Barry, because the paperwork involved is going to be absolutely stunningly onerous. And the only word I can come up with. Because what's going to happen is you're basically going to spend all your time filling out this form, that form, another form to make sure that it gets passed. And you're going to have to write it in such a way that it gets past the quote-unquote panels that are going to be set up to decide whether or not someone can get their health care or not. Now, you know, Sarah Palin got made fun of and continues to be made fun of for claiming that there were death panels in this thing. There are death panels in this thing. There are panels that decide whether you or not you are worthy of treatment. And the fact is that there will be people who could get life-saving treatment who won't get it because it will have to be rationed. Now, let's face it. All healthcare now is currently rationed. It has to be, Barry, because you can't, with the current system, not everybody can get all the health care that is available. And not everybody will be able to get all the health care that is available to them under the new system either.
That's
right. In fact, if the government panel decides that you're not worthy of treatment and you don't have money in your pocket to go someplace else and buy it privately, you're done.
That's absolutely true.
If you need a liver transplant and you're past a certain age and you have other health considerations, you're not going to get it. As it is now, you might be able to do a fundraiser and have people help you pay for a liver transplant on your own.
Mm-hmm.
It's done all the time. You'll see these things where somebody's, you know, got cancer, is out of a job, can't afford the treatment, and people help raise money for it. Good luck. You won't be able to do that under the new system. In fact, it's illegal.
Oh, absolutely. Well, you know what? And if folks want a visual of this, and I'm sending you a link of this, Chuck, and we need to put it up on our website. If you want a visual of what this new system looks like, there was a graphic that was done by one of the Republican staff in the Senate, I believe, was the, I don't know which person did it, but it basically shows the flow chart of all of the responsibilities, agencies, etc., that are set up under Obamacare. If it was fully implemented, which it's going to be now with the ruling from the United States Supreme Court. And, you know, Chuck, it's just absolutely mind-numbing. And the thing is, I pulled up I popped up a large copy, because you've got these little teeny boxes, and there are diamonds, and there are circles and squares and octagons all over this place, and a bunch of lines going from place to place that looks like a map of an electrical panel. But what it really occurred to me is I'm looking at it here, because right smack in the middle is the big red circle that says Secretary of Health and Human Services, and then up a little higher is IRS, and then the President and Congress are on either corner. Government health benefit exchanges, essential health benefit packages, all of those are in big letters, and then there are certain what I call alphabet soup agencies, PCORI, IPAB, And all of that stuff obviously is explained out in the graphic under the chart, because it shows, okay, this is new government. Some of these circles and squares represent new government agencies. Some of it represents expanded government. Some of it is the relationship with private entities that will be involved. And then new relationships, the lines are relationships that are formed between these. Chuck, I sat there and I looked at it for a couple of seconds, and the first thing it hits you is it looks like a circuit board, because it's in a very, very complex circuit board at that. But then it dawned on me, you know what it really looks like? It looks like a map of Washington, D.C. It really does, because over here you have Congress, and there, right in the center, you know, even though the president's supposedly up in the corner, right in the center is the White House. And you've got, you know, all of these various, you know, national monuments and buildings. It looks like a map of downtown Washington, D.C.
I just opened it, and you're right, it does.
So, ladies and gentlemen, you know what? It may have been unintentional psychological issues, but that's the inside the Beltway mentality is really laid out for this. Now, ladies and gentlemen, go to our website at principlepolicy.com after this program today, or if you can, while you're listening to it, if you're listening to us on the radio or on live streaming, go over, click on the link that we're going to be putting up here, and hopefully Chuck will have that link up before the end of the hour today, with this map. Now, again, this is, like I said, this is a map, and it comes from the United States Senate Republicans, who, after Obamacare was passed, put together this flow chart to show you exactly what was in the bill. Now, remember, this was an over 2,000-page piece of legislation that nobody, not one single congressman or senator, had read through and understood before they voted on it back in April of 2010. If you remember that, Chuck, they basically had 72 hours. The bill was dropped on their desk and they had a vote and they had 72 hours and it was over. It might have been over 3,000 pages. I'm going to have to look that up, but I know it was over 2,000.
It was 2,700 pages by the time.
So yeah. 2,700 page document that sets up, well, what is in this graph, which is a map of downtown D.C. or a very complex electronic circuit board with all various and sundry new and existing federal and private agencies and expanded government. I mean, it's just absolutely breathtaking. Now, many folks may have seen this because, you know, this has been floated around as a poster by various conservative and constitutional groups trying to get people to understand why it's important for it to be overturned. Well, right now they're still at it, Charles, because if the court's ruling is allowed to stand, and that's something we've got to talk about too, because folks, ladies and gentlemen, just because John Roberts and four liberals wrote their thoughts out on a piece of paper, well, actually, they wrote them out on 193 pieces of paper, Charles, because the majority opinion, the ruling on Obamacare was 193 pages long. Now, I'm going to be quite honest up front, ladies and gentlemen. I've not read through all 193 pages of it. Maybe I'm as guilty as Congress is of not reading the bill, but I've read enough of it to understand the breathtaking scope of what John Roberts and the liberals on the court actually did. However, you know what? We still have an opportunity, and we're going to talk about that more probably in the second half of the program, to undo the damage. Although I'm going to say right now, Charles, I'm not exactly optimistic about that.
Well, Barry, let's talk about something for a minute. If I, as a congressman, were handed a 2,700 page bill, I would announce immediately, I don't care what this thing has in it, I'm voting no.
That's right, exactly. It's like, if it's got that many pages, they must be using it to hide something.
That's right. I don't care if it hands everybody a check for $1 million and says that we're going to get a month full of Sundays where we can all sit around and do nothing. The fact is, I'm voting no for the thing, because you cannot have a 2,700 page. If you've handed someone a 2,700 page bill, it's designed to confuse and obfuscate.
Oh, absolutely.
It can't have anything in it that would be good. So I would say instantly no. Now, I also want to make a comment about this graph.
Mm-hmm.
Who's at the center?
Well, the Secretary of Health and Human Services.
Now, who's in small letters in the upper right-hand corner?
Congress.
Now, let's talk about this for a minute. In the Founding Fathers' original design, where is the bulk of power? Let's forget about this idea that there are three...
Co-equal
branches, because there are not.
No, the legislative authority was supposed to be the strongest branch.
Absolutely it was. Now, I just gave a talk on the Electoral College, and part of that talk on the Electoral College was pointing out how much power Congress actually has. We did a score sheet on who has more control. For instance, Congress has the capability of removing members of both the judiciary and the executive branches. Congress has the right, can basically override vetoes that the executive branch does. Congress has all these powers, and yet in this thing, it's in little tiny print up in the upper right-hand corner. Even the president is sort of up in the left-hand corner, very appropriately. And I'm looking at groups who are involved in the healthcare thing, and look, what do I see? Homeland Security Department. Why is the Homeland Security Department involved in the healthcare law?
Oh, that's a good question, and I think we'll find out the answer to as it's implemented.
Yeah, there's all kinds of stuff here. But the Labor Department, Justice Department.
Yes, that's right, Chuck. But, you know, you pointed out one thing in the upper right-hand corner. I want to point out something in the very lower right-hand corner of this graph. And it's a little teeny word way down in the corner that says patients.
Yep.
So, yes, you're part of the healthcare system, but there's only one line coming out to you, and that line is, and you're not connected to anything else. So basically, you have no relationship, as it were, with anything else going on in this particular diorama. You just are there, and that is it. And basically, it's the individual mandate and the health insurance. So basically, that's all you've got the connection to. And the funny thing is, Chuck, if you look at that, patients is way over in the lower right-hand corner. In the very lower left-hand corner are physicians. But it's funny how there's no relationship lines between physicians and patients.
But look at the bureaucracy. Now, this can't be cheap, Barry. Hospital quality reporting program, physician value-based payment modifier, physician quality reporting system, long-term care hospital, blah, 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 annual fee. Oh, except that goes to the pharmaceutical companies. Hang on. Which are also off in a corner by the physicians. I'm sure not to their... to their liking. But look at this. One line goes from patients, and where does it go to? Mandate, regulations, and taxes.
Yep. Mandates, regulations, and taxes, and lists out all the sections in the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act that deal with that direct relationship with a patient. And there's one, two, three, well, there's a whole section, you know, like runs of sections. There are dozens of sections of this 2,700-page law now that deals with the relationship to patients, and that relationship is what they call in this flowchart a structural connection. In other words, that is a structural connection. What happens, Chuck, with a structural connection if you sever it?
Well, what happens? The structure collapses.
The structure collapses. So, ladies and gentlemen, that's part of what I'm saying is that we as American citizens, and of course it doesn't say citizens, it just says patients. So that's what we all are now. We're patients. We have a structural connection to all of these mandates, regulations, and taxes, and it needs to be severed. And there are ways that we can do that. Again, we're going to talk about that a little bit later. But then we've got all of these various things. I mean, I just thought it was funny, Chuck, because as I look this closer and closer, it is true that patients and physicians have absolutely no connection to each other.
No, they don't.
No structural connection. You'd think that would be the basic structural connection in any health care plan is the doctor-patient relationship. But under this plan and all of its many, many layers and levels of bureaucracy lies no connection whatsoever between patients and physicians. And I've looked very carefully. There is only one line going from patients, and that is a structure, like I said, we structural connection. Now, there are a number of feedbacks and lines going back and forth between physicians and some of the structures that are being put in place here, and some of them are structural, mandates, regulations, taxes, and payment cuts are linked directly to physicians. And then they're also linked to things like physician quality reporting system, physician value-based payment modifiers, health hospital quality reporting programs. There's a number of things, like I said, that they're linked to in this or feed it and are linked back to them that are just absolutely, Charles, frankly, and you just look at this and I think you probably add a quality multiplier for the cost of healthcare for how many things are between a physician and a patient under the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act.
Well, look, that whole affordable thing, let's look at it. some of these things that are connected to the individual mandates, regulations, and taxes explain why it's not going to be affordable. 10% tax on indoor tanning services. Only medical expenses above 10% of income are tax deductible. Contributions required. Basically taxes applied to businesses.
Mm-hmm.
Employer mandate, provide health insurance. Again, it's going to be very difficult to have affordable health care at any cost when you don't have a job because your employer cannot afford to employ you any longer and decides, you know what, we can hire somebody in India at a fraction of the cost that we can hire an American employee.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So what does that do to the quote-unquote affordability of the Affordable Care Act? The fact is it becomes unaffordable at any cost, even free, because you no longer have a job because of it. It's an, yes, indirect consequence, yes. But is it a consequence? You bet it is.
Oh, absolutely. And
is it an economic consequence? Yes, it is. Now, what I'm noticing is that you can actually get from patients to physicians if you follow certain lines, but that, guess where the lines go through?
Oh, they have to all go through HHS.
Yep, they go up through the secretary. Health and Human Services.
And ladies and gentlemen, I'll tell you what, if you want to sit and try to trace these lines, good luck, because there are at least five different color of lines, or four different colors, no, five different colors of lines that are running all throughout this. Like I said, it looks like an integrated circuit board, Charles, for something that's extremely complex. If you want to try to follow all of these jump lines, good luck.
It's amazing how complex this really is, and yet. And I was, you know, this was obviously put out by the opposition to the law, but it doesn't matter who it was put out by. If this is anywhere close to correct, let's say it's only 75% correct, this is still nightmarish for both the consumer and the physician. What this is going to do, of course, is make healthcare even less available. We're already hearing stories, basically, and these are more than anecdotal stories, out of Great Britain that has, you know, their HHS service, their health service is nightmarish there. They've got people who basically won't go. People are being frightened out of medical school because it's so unbelievably costly. And when you get out, your salary is capped. And you are basically a state employee. You no longer work for yourself. You essentially work for the state, even if you have a private practice. And it has taken a grave toll on the quality of the healthcare in Great Britain. Don't be sucked in by this idea that, you know, healthcare under these socialized services is so much better. It is not. In Britain, there are people that go in to have operations for instance, if they've got diabetes and are having a foot removed, they will themselves take a magic marker and mark the spot and say, take this foot and not the other one.
Oh, boy.
You know, that kind of stuff. There was a story in the Mail the other day that I read that a fellow was in the hospital being treated for cancer and got to the point he was not being given fluids, and it got to the point where he called their emergency medical service and asked that someone please come and give him, you know, he basically called what the British equivalent of 911, and the cop showed up to say, you know, we've got a report of someone who is not being given fluid and is demanding fluids, and they were stopped at the desk and said, don't worry about it, he's fine. And within 24 hours, he was dead from dehydration. So this is the kind of thing that goes on in a national health service.
Oh, absolutely.
This is the kind of thing we're letting ourselves in for. Now, I have read a number of things. You know, the naysayers always come out, and we talk about the Canadian service and how people are coming across the border to get American services, and these guys always poo-poo it and say, well, you've given me these anecdotal stories. Well, the fact is they're becoming statistical. Canadian hospitals or American hospitals on this side of the Canadian border very often have a large number of Canadian patients because they can come in and get elective services they might have to wait 12 or 18 months in Canada for it. Over here, they can just pay. If they're willing to pay out of pocket, they can come get it. Well, that's getting ready to come to a halt. And that is actually the plan. Unfortunately, it's to ration healthcare, and people are being suckered into this idea that they're going to get free healthcare. Under certain circumstances, yes. Under other circumstances, you're going to get no healthcare, and it depends on how valuable you are to the state. And that's exactly what happens in these systems, sadly.
Well, yes, but we're just seeing the first edges of that right now. We've had this situation, Chuck, and we've talked about this on this program before. We've had this situation for a lot longer time than just in the last couple of years. Ever since the government really started inserting themselves into healthcare decisions with third-party payer systems, et cetera, going all the way back to the early 70s, we've had issues with our healthcare system. But I think this is just more almost the coup de grace when it gets right down to it of turning us into a country that has fully socialized medicine. And we can
thank John Roberts,
the conservative on the United States Supreme Court, for giving us this decision. And Chuck, the more I look at this, we will talk about that in just a second. But the more I look at Roberts's philosophy and his rationale and reasoning in coming to this conclusion, the more confused I'm getting. So let's talk about that particular portion first, then we'll come back to the Roberts thing in a minute.
Yeah, I think we need to talk about the fact that the astronomical increases in the cost of healthcare and things like insurance and those kinds of things really has taken place since the government started meddling in it. And remember that most people did not have health insurance before World War II. In World War II, health insurance was really used by war industries to get and keep employees who they wanted to keep because, people would, during the war, you have a shortage of manpower, and they wanted to keep good employees. So they would offer healthcare, this healthcare insurance, so that people wouldn't run off to another industry that offered it. And all of a sudden, it moved from something that was an elective thing in order to keep good employees to a required thing in order to stay in business. And as that has become more and more and more and more prevalent in the thinking of government, healthcare and healthcare insurance has become more and more and more expensive.
Yes, it has.
And the regulatory aspects of this, Barry, I just went through kind of a nightmare because I don't have standard insurance. You and I are both on the same plan. We're on the Samaritan plan.
Which?
And I want to give a plug to Samaritan, though they're not. Yeah.
We'll have a link up on our website so that you can look at and check out Samaritan Ministries. And please, if you do, if you look at it and you decide that that's something you want to do, let us know and or suggest that you heard about it through our website when you apply to Samaritan.
Yeah, by the way, we don't have any relationship other than our own membership in Samaritan, so we're getting nothing out of this. It would be nice if you mentioned one of our names if you decide to go into Samaritan because, there are incentives for that. But if you choose not to, that's fine. Like I said, we're not taking any money from Samaritan. We are both supporters of the Samaritan system because it is a Christian-based expense-sharing program that, frankly, is a wonderful way of handling this kind of a problem. Now, that being said, the government has basically made it virtually impossible now because I went to the doctor the other day, and because I don't have standard insurance, we had issues with some lab costs. And, you know, they always have to come out and talk to me. Well, we don't take your plan. And I go, well, I don't have this because I don't have a plan. You guys draw blood, you do the test, and you send me the bill and I pay it, you know. Well, how can you do that? And I'm like, because it's a cost of health. I mean, I was paying $10,000 a year for health insurance. Believe me, I can pay my $355 a month to Samaritan and still have some money left over to pay for some lab expenses. Now, I looked at why it's so expensive. That my doctor has an entire floor. They rent part of a floor of a building. The floor above them is for record keeping.
Yep.
That's required by the federal government. They have an entire department who sits there and does nothing but keeps hold of your medical records, of which is very difficult for you to get. Your wife cannot get it almost under any circumstances unless you basically sign away your firstborn. And the only people that can get a look at those records with any kind of ease is the federal government.
Yes.
Under the HIPPA, the Health Insurance Portability and Protection Act, Privacy and Protection Act, the only people that can look at your health records with any kind of ease is the federal government. And it's been that way. The federal government should never be able to look at your health insurance records under any circumstances except under the issuance of a court order by a federal judge. But hey, you pass one law and voila, your records are the federal records.
And this was a lead. Neat?
Well, this was a lead up to this legislation. And all the good quote unquote conservatives who voted for this law, and there were plenty of them, were sold on it for, you know, a number of stupid reasons that anybody could have basically negated on any kind of serious thought about it. But the fact is that they didn't think about it. They got caught up in the emotion, and they got caught up in the fact that so-and-so needs this power, and therefore we're going to pass this law. So the only people who's really protected from any kind of problem with HIPPA is the federal government.
Of course.
Who now no longer needs a court order to get at your personal records. Well, so voila,
exactly. Well, you know, Chuck, it's again, we see very clearly that when we stray from constitutional boundaries, what we end up with is a loss of our freedom, our liberty, our privacy, our ability to provide for our own families. And all the things that we hold dear as part of what we call the American dream. But I think, again, we talked about this over the last couple of days about conservatives who rah-rah for these Supreme Court nominees because they're one of us, and then we find that they're not really one of us, and us being folks who would think that, yes, we should have the American dream still holds, that, the traditional or conservative ways of looking at things, and, you know, we talked about the difference between conservative and constitutional. There are some of us who believe the constitutional way of looking at things is the best, but many who think that, you know, being conservative and doing unto others, et cetera, the golden rule, those are all good things, and that all of these folks that are being put up for the courts are thinking the same way we are. Well, I want to take a look real quick, if we have a little time here, at Chief Justice John Roberts' thought processes in relation to the decision that he issued giving us the quote-unquote constitutional Obamacare. and making that chart an actual reality, although we all knew that the government was moving forward with all those connections and agencies already and have been for decades. First thing, I guess, and this is a report, and I don't know if this has been verified or not, ladies and gentlemen, but I think it's interesting because, as we know, nobody in Congress had time to read the 2,000-plus pages of Obamacare before they voted to put it into place. It was brought forward last week when the ruling was put out by the court that none of the members of the court had read through the entire 2,000-plus pages of Obamacare. So, Chuck, right now, you know, we're batting 1,000 that people are doing this and not reading the bill. Now, that's not true here at the Institute for Principal Policy, because our chairman of the board, Dr. Mark Hamilton at Ashland University, actually took the time to read entirely through the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, and we have some analysis of that on our website.
Absolutely.
But Stephen,
in fact, he took a week off to be able
He took a week off from school in order to set and go through that bill. And obviously, some folks in the Senate Republican Caucus went through it carefully too, because that's where that chart came from. Because everything in that chart is linked to a section of the law, and I say the law in quotes, ladies and gentlemen. When you hear it, I'm not saying that it's legitimate. I'm saying it's just what's passing for what they call law these days. But then John Roberts, in writing his opinion, now I thought this was interesting, Chuck. I don't know if you've seen this or not, but Terrence Jeffrey over at CNS News website.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
You know
about.
The one I'm talking
about. I saw
about,
this article,
basically
yeah.
Calling the Roberts Doctrine that stopping at red lights is optional now. And he goes through and has this long explanation. But what he does bring out are certain quotes from the opinion, and I think these are very important for us to look at. You know, he said basically that, okay, Section 5000A of the Obamacare bill, yes, almost Section 5000, that's the individual mandate. That's saying that you must buy health insurance, and if you don't, you're going to be penalized. It's called the requirement to maintain minimum essential coverage. And the section says an applicable individual, that's everybody but somebody who works in Congress, an applicable individual shall for each month beginning after 2013, so in other words, we've got less than 6 months before this thing kicks in, or 2014, depending on how they want to interpret that, ensure that the individual and any dependent of the individual who's an applicable individual is covered under minimum essential coverage for such month. If an applicable individual fails to meet the requirement, there is hereby imposed a penalty with respect to the individual in the amount determined under another subsection. And it says subsection C, but we're not going to read into that. But the point is that that's basically straightforward saying you've got to maintain, the federal government's going to tell you what your minimum coverage level is, and then you must maintain it every month, or we will fine you. A penalty is a fine. Shall maintain means you don't have any other option. And a requirement means that it isn't a great suggestion. It's mandated. So we've got all this. And so when Roberts argues that this whole issue, he says that, you know what? First of all, there was an act involved in the bill that said that you can't sue until after the law has been actually applied. Yeah, so, but obviously, the reason why we have a case for the Supreme Court was people sued. And there was an issue of whether or not standing was going to apply, because he says, well, that doesn't apply to this because the mandate is enforced with a penalty and not a tax. You see, ladies and gentlemen, everybody thinks that John Roberts said that the penalty is a tax, but in part of his ruling, he said that it's a penalty, not a tax, okay? So he keeps going. No, I'm serious, Chuck. I'm not kidding. And he says that he keeps going on, and then he says, well, that Congress used the word tax in other places in Obamacare, and he says, when Congress uses certain language in one part of a statute and different language in another, it's generally presumed that Congress acts intentionally. So now he's saying that since they didn't use the word tax and used the word penalty in the individual mandate issue, they meant penalty and not tax. And he says, well, the Commerce Clause, the constitutional clause that gives Congress the power to regulate commerce, did not authorize Congress to enact the minimum essential coverage requirement. In other words, individual mandate. He says that the requirement mandated and compelled Americans to do what the government said, and he says they do not have the power to order people to buy health insurance. Wow, this sounds like a totally different decision, doesn't it, Chuck?
Yeah.
But then he contradicts himself, and he says the text of a statute can sometimes have more than one possible meaning.
Wow, talk about doublespeak.
Yeah, and he says the most straightforward reading of the mandate is that it commands individuals to purchase insurance. That seems to be the reading you and I have, Charles, because that's what it looks like to me. And he says, but then he rewrites it into a tax. And this is Terrence Jeffrey commenting. He says, then he rewrites it into a tax. What he just said Congress had deliberately written into the law is a penalty. And he says, well, people need not fill the requirement, says they shall fulfill as long as they're willing to pay the tax for not fulfilling it. So in other words, if you're willing to be penalized and you're willing to pay it and not fulfill it, then it's not necessarily a mandate, and therefore it's a tax and not a penalty.
Okay, so what if you're not willing to pay the tax and you're not willing to pay the penalty?
Or you're not willing to carry the coverage. You're not willing to pay the penalty or the tax. What happens? You get thrown in prison, Chuck. That's what happens.
Well, that's right. by the IRS.
Yeah.
Now, it's interesting you say this because I'm on Breitbart.com.
Yep.
On their big government website. And here is an article titled Wrong, Wrong, Wrong. The Supreme Court's worst decision since Kelo. And let's face it, Kelo was simply an awful decision.
And for folks, that's the City of New London versus Kelo, which was the decision that made David Souter actually ultimately have to step down from the United States Supreme Court, when they decided that a government of any level can take your property if they want to turn it over to somebody else to get more taxes out of it.
That's right. Now, here's a quote from the article. According to Chief Justice John Roberts and his liberal colleagues on the Supreme Court, Congress does not have to call a tax in order for it to be a tax. Congress can, in fact, create a penalty instead of a tax, and the president can tell the nation it is not a tax, but the courts can later decide Congress meant otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what he's talking about here. But and then Roberts also writes, and I want to get this in there too. He says that while the individual mandate clearly aims to induce the purchase of health insurance, well, I would say the word mandate would aim to induce. He goes on, it need not be read to declare that failing to do so is unlawful. Says neither the act nor any other law attaches negative legal consequences to not buying health insurance beyond requiring a payment to the IRS. Chuck, I'm not sure what planet John Roberts came from, but the whole idea of the government telling you that if you don't do something, we will fine you and attach penalties to you is a taking that is beyond a tax. That's truly a fine. It's a pecuniary, punitive exercise of power by a federal agency. So the IRS can come in and say, well, you know what? If you don't choose to carry this healthcare coverage, well, the healthcare coverage we want you to cover is $15,000 a year. Well, you're not buying it. Well, it's going to cost you $23,600 in penalties not to take this insurance. And I'm making the numbers up, of course. But the whole point is that, so what do you do then if you say, well, you know what? I'm not required to do this, so I'm not paying your penalty. I do believe, Charles, that if you look at the statutes relating to the Internal Revenue Service, they do have other legal consequences that are negative that they can impose upon an individual who refuses to pay the IRS.
Well, that's right. They'll just simply seize your bank account or your house or your business or whatever.
And let me throw a name out there for ladies and gentlemen who probably would be familiar with it, but this audience would. A gentleman by the name of Kent Hovind, who's now sitting in a federal detention center in the state of Florida for not paying that negative legal consequence to the IRS.
Yeah, exactly. Basically, let's be clear about what Hovind did. It wasn't so much that he refused to pay a tax.
Uh-huh.
He paid all his taxes. What he refused to do was become a withholding agency.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Hovind basically had everybody work as a private contractor, which means they were responsible for all sections of their own taxes. In other words, he didn't pay for the additional tax for the Social Security and the Medicare. He didn't pay withholders portions of other taxes. He basically, each employee was responsible for that. He refused to become a withholding agency.
Okay, well, and that's fine too. But you know what we get right down to is, and this was the argument that Terrence Jeffrey made in his article, was okay. If that's the case, there is no constitutional provision in the Constitution to authorize Congress to order individuals to buy products they don't want, i.e. health insurance. But he said it would be no different than Congress enacting a requirement that you shall stop your car at a red light on a U.S. Army base, and if you violate the requirement, you must pay a penalty. He said, well, it's no different except Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17 of the Constitution does authorize Congress to make traffic laws for military bases, because Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17 basically says that they have exclusive legislation in all cases over the districts, etc., and to exercise like authority over all places purchased by the consent of the legislature of the state in which the same shall be for the erection of forts, magazines, arsenals, dockyards, and other needful buildings. In other words, a military base. They have the ability under the Constitution to pass that kind of a requirement, but there's no requirement in the Constitution. You cannot go to Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1, the taxing power, and stretch or twist that in any way to say, well, if you don't buy something that we think is good for you, we can make you pay a penalty to a government agency to do so.
Oh, what a tangled web we weave.
That's exactly what we're getting around to, ladies and gentlemen. That's what we said. Once you get away from the Constitution itself and you start trying to make it up as you go along, you run into this judicial doublespeak of John Roberts, where in one part of your ruling, you're saying, well, if they said penalty, they didn't mean tax. But you get all the way around to the end of it and say, well, since we can say that a law... it's not unlawful to not follow this mandated law, so they can charge you a penalty, and therefore, well, that's a tax. It's Chuck. I hope that someday we'll see the notes, or people will understand what the thinking was behind this from Chief Justice Roberts. But right now, I'm kind of wondering if there wasn't some external issues at play. And I don't know exactly what those external issues might have been, but supposedly from a legal mind such as John Roberts, who's supposedly, well, now the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court, to come up with this kind of legal ledger domain, it doesn't bode well for the future of the Republic.
No, it doesn't. And, you know, we're almost out of time here. But what I'm going to say is some of the pundits have been arguing, and I think correctly, that what Roberts did here essentially was protect his own quote-unquote legacy in the media. He didn't want to get bashed as so many other basically, as we talked about, Clarence Thomas's reputation is ruined forever. Yes, he's on the Supreme Court, but as you and I discussed off air, you still see captions under that talk about Anita Hill in positive terms and him in negative terms. He doesn't want that. He wants to go down in history as someone who made this marvelous decision, and he came up with this mishmash of a decision that is basically going to be long-term horrific for the country. Now, with that being said, I have to say we are out of time. Join us again on Monday for another Principles and Policies, and thanks for being with us.